The Rove's point of departure, his method, his objective, was not formal scholastic philosophy of religion, but rather a glorious masora of Ahavas Hashem, of Chovos Halvovos, of a Sefer Hamada, which integrated Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah and Hilchos Deos and Hilchos Talmud Torah, a masora of Zohar and Shari Ora, of Reishis Chochma and Mesilas Yesharim. Precisely, a masora in which the dialectic of ideas provides a natural, nurturing framework for the primary religious experience. The Rav is in the tradition of the fifth book of Chovos Halvavos and the fascinating chapter 51 of the end of Mor HaNevuchim, which insists that knowledge of God is necessary for the service of God. This is intellectualism, but not a self-contained, a self-sufficient intellectualism. Kein yovin mi sheyirtze lehovin chidos hanevuah, v'yeyor mishnas hashichacha, v'inotzel miyam hasichlus, v'yale el ha'elyonim. The Rambam writes. This needs to be seen and understood because it's a vital maaseh rav. Mention of the name of the Rav conjures up in the imagination a scholar of awesome learning. But that's only one part. My son, who here at the yeshiva, reminded me that Rav Chaim Oza of Vilna said about Rav Chaim Briska, he was so brilliant that people were blinded by his brilliance and could not recognize his other noble traits. What's true for the grandfather is true for the grandson. All his drushes are brilliant, no question about that. They cite and interpret an amazing array of sources with enthralling originality. But these brilliant drushes would not have been possible without his religious sensitivity, his masterful evocation of his own experience, his delicate depiction of his father and grandfathers, of his mother and grandmothers, of the entire Masora. Indeed, I would be bold for a moment and say that his books, as formidable and forbidding as they are also structured around religious scenes, anecdotes, traditions, family vignettes and portraits. This was all premeditated, just as the Rambam regularly relates a most technical philosophic disquisition to a pasuk or to a maimon chazal. Anybody who looks closely at the writings of the Rambam, not only the Mor HaNevuchim, but the whole corpus, will recognize this stylistic structural aspect of the Rambam. So just as the Rambam regularly relates a most technical philosophic exposition to a pasuk or to a maimon chazal, so the Rav uses a series of stories, of family anecdotes and memories to energize and concretize his philosophic analysis. Actually, the intellectual sophistication is harmoniously integrated with experiential intensity and religious sensitivity. You stop to think for a moment, just a fleeting moment. What is the content and message of his major works? The Ish Halacha teaches that the halachic person not only acts differently as a result of the religious spiritual regimen of halacha, but thinks differently as a result of its categories and constructs. Ish Halacha has a special perception of events and forces because he sees things through special lenses. He operates with special categories which endow natural phenomena and historical developments with meaningfulness and purposiveness. The halachic mind provides philosophic scientific justification for this description. It vindicates a spiritual autonomy resulting from a theory of epistemological pluralism. And the third major work, Uvikashta Misham, analyzes the religious experience of the Ish Halacha not only in the cognitive level, but in the subjective experiential terms. The word lathe appears in almost every subtitle, in every caption of that remarkable work, which can only be read with great excitement. All of these reflect the same structural pattern: abstract, analytical, dialectical prose laced with lyrical scenes, with autobiographical or familial stories or themes taken from the Masorah. When the Rav denies any claim to systematic theology, as he frequently does, he is in fact being a true, authentic theologian, which means a person of religious vision, of avoda and Torah, questing for an encounter with the divine. Ka'ayol taro galafike mayim. It follows from this that to look for contradictions and inconsistencies in his various works is a rather shallow approach. It has been noted that style is a mixture of self-expression and self-control. In our idiom, we would say, Yosem imashe karisi lifneichem kosuv kan. Therefore, it's only natural, quite predictable, and fully understandable that the degree of expression and control will vary, that different modes of self will be selectively expressed. We'll find varying exposures, different modalities, and successive moods. All of which, none can be omitted, all of which, taken together, produce a complete picture. Only those who don't see the Kosov Hashlishi will judge these mixtures of self-expression and self-control as Ksuvim Hamachishim Zeh. Actually, the way these have to be understood is Divrei Torah Aniyim Bimkomam Vashirim B'makom Acher. Third, the Rav's uniqueness enabled him to enhance Kvod HaTorah. I want to mention a story that I had occasion to mention earlier, that the Beis HaLevi met Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, and on that occasion he would repeat to him some chidushim of his son Rabbi Chaim. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta listened attentively and responded, "The next generation will study Torah that way and will beat the Haskalah." The question is, what's the connection between these two parts of his statement? Clearly, he meant to say that in addition to the religious metaphysical commitment, young people need an intellectual challenge, an intellectual satisfaction. Many thought mistakenly, tragically so, that in Haskalah, that's what they would find. And that's why an analytic, conceptual method equal to any in its rigor and profundity, in its discipline and results, would rehabilitate halacha while repudiating the spurious claims of Haskalah. Now, as far as I know, the Rav doesn't tell this story anywhere. But I found one sentence in his hesped on the Brisker Rav. That whole hesped is as much about Reb Chaim as you would expect. It contains a spirited characterization of Reb Chaim's method. And in talking about Reb Chaim, he has the following line: "Bameh haya kocho yafe." What was the secret of Reb Chaim's genius and his influence? "Bameh haya kocho yafe she'ilmolei hu Oysa mishtakachas Torah miYisrael, v'lo hayinu yicholim laharbitz olsa b'tkufa zu." We would not be able to teach and disseminate Torah in this age, in our generation, if not for Reb Chaim. The Rav, more than anyone, enhanced Kvod HaTorah. He was the teacher who did successfully disseminate Torah in this age, emphasizing the nobility and the beauty of the process and the content. And fourthly, finally, this uniqueness also underlies the abundance and bountifulness of his teaching. For this, I would suggest the following perspective. First, there is the fact of Ulahoros Nasan Belibo. Ibn Ezra comments in this pasuk about Salel at the beginning of Vayakhel, Ki yesh chacham gam charash lo yuchal lahoros hetev. Extraordinary ability to communicate ideas is a special gift, a special dimension of genius. Not every person, even one possessed of great learning, is blessed with this ulahoros nasan belibo. The Rav had it, and his teaching, marked by such versatility and virtuosity, was like a spring flowing with undiminished, ever-increasing strength. But the lahoros nasan belibo is just one part of it. Alongside of this extraordinary ability was his unfailing readiness to teach. His real greatness, it seems to me, intellectual and moral greatness, lay in this amazing readiness to teach and to converse effectively and vigorously and intelligibly on all levels, and to do so sympathetically and graciously in a way that simultaneously satisfied and stimulated the student. In order for the Rav to give a shiur or a drasha or a lecture, he had to engage in an act of tzimtzum. He had to restrict and restrain a mighty intellect and channel it, to select prudently from an awesome erudition in a carefully controlled way. Otherwise, students and listeners would have drowned in the sea of Torah, of his Torah. This is the consummate expression of combined intellectual and moral prowess, of magnanimity, of generosity and graciousness. The Gemara in the Nedarim says, Lo nitna Torah ela l'moshe ulazaro. And Moshe Rabbeinu could have kept it. But Moshe nohag bo tovas ayin. Moshe Rabbeinu displayed the trait of generosity, of bountifulness. Moshe nohag bo tovas ayin in the son of Israel. For all of hakosav omer tov ayin hu yivorach. The Rav was a great tov ayin. He shared his unparalleled learning with everyone. Rabbonim and Talmidim, Balabatim, young and old, in large groups and small groups, even in private. In a way that's reminiscent of the Gemara in Ksubis, Ki havu miftere Rabbonan mibei Rav, havu faishe alfa umasan. One group left, another group came. One shiur ended, another started, with just enough time to prepare, because nothing would be done inadvertently or without careful premeditation. In addition to this tovas ayin, the Rav felt and compellingly expressed the idea, and I quote, that ein hanavua v'gam hachochma kinyan hayochid shayochos heino lakol. The halacha of Novi, HaKovesh Estivuoso, Chai of Misa Bidei Shemayim, has to govern the behavior and the attitude of the Chacham as well. The Rav untiringly illustrated what he emphasized in explaining the Rambam, that study and teaching, Lilmod HaTorah Ululamda, or in the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Lulamed comes first. But Lilmod HaTorah Lulamda constitute one unified mitzvah. His magnanimity making his great mind and soul available to those who thirsted for Dvar Hashem. This magnanimity, as well as the inherent charm and cogency, pedagogic skill, and rhetorical power of all his teaching, resulted in an indescribably widespread impact, which literally made him the Rabban Shel Yisrael. Hamavorech Misborech. My son in Yerushalayim mentioned Thursday night the Biur Hagra on the Pasuk Yafutsu Mayinosecha Chutza. Bimlamed La'acherim Yeshnei Dvarim, the Gra writes. Aleph Shemlamed Ba'atzmo La'acherim. Beis Heim Osam Shelo Lomdu Etzlo Raksha Taraso Mispashetes B'chol HaMekomos V'shomim Taraso V'lomdim Osa. This is what happened to the teaching of the Rav. Taraso Mispashetes, in the present tense, continues. Taraso Mispashetes B'chol HaMekomos. And this is what made him Rabban Shel Yisrael. Al hay gavra yichido ko bachina schuso yagen aleinu.
For the recitation of Tehillim, we call upon the president of our rabbinical alumni, past president of the Rabbinical Council of America, Rabbi Beryl Rosenzweig.
Kapitel Tessayin Michtam L'David Shomreini El Kichosi Sivach Omat L'Adonai Adonai Ata Toivosi Baal Olecha V'kdoishim Asher Boretz Heimov Yadire Kochev Tzivom Yuvatzvoisom Achem Oru Balasich Niskei Emidom Uvaleso Eshemoisom Al Sufosai Adinoi Menos Chelki Vechoisi Ata Toimich Goroli Kavolim Nofluli Banimim Af Nachlos Shofra Olai Avorech Asadinoi Asher Yotzoni Af Leilois Yisruni Chilyoisoi Shivisi Adinoi V'negdi Somit Ki Mimini Balemoit Lochein somach libi vayogel kivoidi af besori yishkoin lovetach ki loy sazoi v'nafshi lishol loy sitein chasir chol v'roy shochas Toi di eini oira chayim, soi vas mochois es ponecho, ni imois vi mincho netzach.
Please be seated. We will now hear Divrei Hesped from the son and Talmud of the Rav, Zecher Tzadok Livracha, Yibadlu Chaim, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik Shlita.
The hour is late, and you've sat here for a long time. And many of you have come from a long distance. When Miriam died, Machne Yisrael stopped, is Yana Miyakovid. And the Medrash says that the reason that Knesset Yisrael stopped was because of the Satzei Vachotso Medochok. Todas, Mayikrilo. Years ago, when they put Meisha into the Tevis Goma. Can you hear me? Years ago, when they put Meisha into the Tevis Goma, Miriam stood the distance and waited. And because of that waiting, later on, Knesset Yisrael stopped and waited. My father commuted back and forth from New York for some 45 years. And many times he waited for a delayed train, a late plane. And as he waited then, and for his waiting then, perhaps at his patira, it's not out of place if we detain ourselves a bit. If we detain ourselves a bit. I haven't come to be maspid, my father. As Dr. Lamb said, no one could be maspid, my father, except my father. What I'd like to do is briefly state in some way why I think one can't be maspid him. And then, more importantly, share with you some experiences, insights of a son, a Talmud, and a person who's been close to a decade studying his early Ksavim, which go back to a time which antedate all our knowledge of himself, perhaps even his own recollection of himself. I have no secrets to reveal, and since we are talking about a person who was on the public platform for 60 years of his life and met freely and openly with everybody in all walks of life, the only value that my remarks have lies in the degree of persuasive correspondence between my characterizations and your own experiences. It is difficult to be maspid, my father, because of the astonishing combination of talents. Since the cornerstone, foundation, and capstone of his accomplishments were in Teira, I will leave that to a second part, just touching on it briefly here. The second part of what I'll be saying. He was, needless to say, creative in learning. But a person who creates inhabits the frontier of a discipline because he has to move rapidly to break its frontiers and its barriers. He also has to think to himself in shorthand in order to make all the steps swiftly enough to achieve an intellectual breakthrough. These talents aren't the talents which make for Hasbara. Because Hasbara, you have to move from the frontier into the center of the population. And you have to speak longhand, even taking people by the hand, step by step. My father was not only a Mahadesh, but he was a Mazdir of extraordinary capacity. Otherwise, most of the people here wouldn't be here now. But the essence of Halacha, good Halacha, is the capacity to see the literal meaning, to perceive its assumption and its entailment, to speak Yeshivish Halachim, Pshat, Geboit, and Gedrungen. And that is often at cross purposes. Indeed, it is at cross purposes with Drush, which is an ability to take a pasuk or a mimer metaphorically and to see it resonant with contemporary meaning. I once asked my father, what is Drush? And he said, Drush is to take a pasuk or a mimer and to make it contemporary. Good Drush is to do that and to do no violence to the words or break the narrative line of the Medrash. But Drush can't only be spoken, says thought. It has to be projected. A darshan, the function of a darshan is not to say new truths, but to make you live, relive old ones, to mint old truths anew, smechim kinesinosim sinai. And he does that one of two ways, either by the power of his personality, or by the power of his language when he speaks in writing. And it's those two aspects I'd like to dwell upon briefly. My father, the one that I knew, and the Talmidim of the 30s, 40s, and the 50s, and I'll come later to the two different men, the many different men, that he was, that he became. My father could step on a platform as large as this, and Beis Medrash HaGadol in Roxbury was, if I'm not mistaken, even larger than this auditorium, Boohoo Ave was certainly. And without a microphone, hold the entire audience in the palm of his hand with the first sentence. That power of holding an audience in the power of his hand, I saw only one other person, and that was with Begin, who could arise upon a platform and with the first sentence, you were captive to his words. The difference was that my father strove to rise, to lift the audience to him. And Begin, being in the profession for the politics that he was, descended to the audience, tried to lead them at their level. But a platform personality is larger than life. And that's usually not a parlor personality. Sitting in a small group of people and talking and speaking. I met Begin Friday evening, and seeing him, you wouldn't have known that he was any different than anybody else. My father was equally effective as a power, if I can use the word, a power personality. were not the timbre of the voice, the grand gesture, but the smile, the eyes. Your conversants watch the smile of the eyes, the windows of the soul. He held people captive and was equally effective. And then he was effective in a third medium, which I don't know any word for. It's not platform. It's not parlor. It was a small gathering of 60, 70 people, which you had in Maria, which you had in Boston, the Chevre Shas. Where the grand line would have been totally out of place, and the distances were too large for the eyes, sparkling eyes, to be noticed. And yet, he wove the same spell around with assembled people, using none of the traits, none of the characteristics that he used on the platform and in private conversation. The spoken word isn't the written word. It is radically different. And someone who attempts to translate the spoken word into the written word will fail. For a simple reason, the spoken word relies upon the personality. The written word has to rely completely on the person's sense of language, the cadence of his prose, and his capacity to persuade at the same time while he evoked. My father's native language, native speaking language, was Yiddish, and he was incomparable in that language. Indeed, I would say that anyone who knew him in English didn't really know him. His native written language was Hebrew. The first time he ever wrote Yiddish was after he was engaged to my mother and they were separated and he had to write her a postcard. He had never written before. And his Hebrew, if you just read Madot Chamidot, is a classic in terms both of its substance and its evocative power. What was more striking about that was that if you heard the Hesped as I did, which was a Hesped Baal Peh, it had nothing to do, no semblance, no resemblance in the manner, the mode of presentation, with the written word. His hesped was Al-Shreisha Shiyoshvu Lakayim Eshtar. That Revel's concern was with Kiyum Shtaras and authenticity. But when he came to write it, that was not the way to get across the man's personality in the written medium. And so he wrote in his incomparable language about each Rosh Hashanah and each Yom Kippur. Philosophy is also a question of assumption and entailment. But the questions which it asks, and the answers which it gives are totally different from the one of halacha, of law. In fact, most lawyers, bali halacha, have no interest in such problems and ways of thinking. He operated equally well in there. And though it was all the combination of all these characteristics which made him so impressive a person, so enormous an impact, I think everyone who came in contact with him realized that the man with larger and whole manifestations. That Yosef Mima Shakarasi Ufanecha Kosit Khan. With all the talent, he was a person whose sum was larger, whose whole was larger than the sum of his parts. And since that is a logical impossibility, it doesn't allow articulation. And that's what Chazal meant, perhaps, when they said, Simen Yofe Odom Shavei Nispat Kavocha. Do you hear? Fine. But all this primipay of talents, great as they were, never obscured for a moment to others, certainly not to him, that he was first and foremost a Rosh Hashiva, or as he used to say, a Melamed. The library on which he was educated, trained by the Zayde, was a very small one. Basically, it was the Rom Shas, the Rom Rif, and the Rambam. The Ramban he never saw until it was republished by Rabbi Zalman, and he got it when he was a rov in Boston, the old 1928 crumbling paper edition. He fell in love with Ramban, and I would say of all Rishonim, the one that he felt the closest to intellectually was the Ramban. And in his spare time, or leisure in the summer, the sefer he would be looking most at would be the Perush Ramban Leter and the Mikros Gdolos of the Sefer HaMitzvot, especially the Shoroshim and Chidushim. The Rashba, he received only when this first photo offset, sometime 47, 48, and began to use it when he started Shabbat. And I recall as a little boy hearing my father say, that ich weiß nicht, Tonya, wie ich gelernt früher unter Rashba. He used it systematically, but it never was the same as Girsa de Yankusa. He was fallible, he made mistakes. You could catch him in a Tesis and a Rambam, but not very often. Those were Munach Bekufsa. Tesis, Rambam, Lachamas, Baba Maya. The Ramban, less munach but in control of. The Rashba, he knew well, but it wasn't second nature. And as for the Ritva, we didn't have it in the house. I brought back the first Ritva in 1958 when they photo offset. It was an education which by necessity and equally of choice chose to contemplate long a few great works and to live on intimacy with them. And what he wrote about Revelvel, about Erisin Nisuin, could have been said with equal justice about him with regard to Rashi, the Rambam. Achrenim practically didn't exist. They had in the house, as you might have expected, a Shagasaria, Turi Evin, Karen Orem, Biuri Akro. The one sefer which you could say, not you could say, you indeed say, he knew well and taught and knew it in and out, was the Minchas Chinuch. Lizi Zayda had a Seder with him in the Minchas Chinuch. And when he first came to Yeshiva and then later, many years later, he himself gave Shiurim in it. The attraction of the Minchas Chinuch and the reason why it was so significant for him was threefold. First of all, Minchas Chinuch broke out of the prison palace of Noshim and Nezikim and ranged over Chol HaTorah Kula, all Taryag Mitzvahs. Secondly, the Minchas Chinuch had what Reb Chaim Eizer once used to call Hoben Tesis, namely the capacity to notice in another sugya, totally different sugya, an extra word in a Tesis or in a Rashi, which meant that in a totally different sugya, they held a shita different from the Rambam. The Minchas Chinuch Mishnah Mamelech had some of that. The Minchas Chinuch introduced into halacha thousands of machlokes. A halacha is a fact. A machlokes is a problem. And so the Minchas Chinuch turned thousands of facts into thousands of problems. And for people with a new method, such a sefer was a revelation. It provided the cutting edge for their insight. There was a third trait in the Minchas Chinuch which drew him, which is almost the obverse of Reb Chaim and the Brisker approach. Reb Chaim's approach would analyze an inherent ambiguity in a concept and then construct the Hechatimtze, which would express that ambiguity. The Minchas Chinuch operated the reverse way. He had an intuitive sense for a problematic case without being able to formulate, or only rarely being able to formulate, what that problem was. And hence, Brisk grasped the Minchas Chinuch because the problems that he created and that he posed, one shook all the all the muskamot. Shook the muskamot of Ironon. And second, because they pointed out that concepts and halacha that was seemingly straightforward and of single meaning actually had embedded within them different meanings, which they were Chaim called tudin. This absence of use of achrenim of any sort, or I would say, and those that he used, he essentially exploited rather than extracted knowledge from them, meant that all knowledge was first-hand knowledge. And that is what made him, in his stormy younger years, which I'll describe later, so formidable an interlocutor with his peers, because everyone draws upon some sort of achrenim, akseis, and nesidus and the like. And when stores away a shita of tesvis is seen through somebody else's eyes, and nothing was more common, and I witnessed it frequently, a Rashba being quoted or a Rambam being quoted in my father's Sashba, not as the fabled story of Reb Chaim Bekunti, but because his knowledge came unmediated, and a formulation which was accurate enough for the purposes of excess, when pocketed and taken as the totality of the shita, was often inaccurate. Such an attempt, an approach, to know without spectacles and only by direct contact the sources, usually to intensity, but also to narrowness of accomplishment. It can express itself in restricting yourself to 7-8 mesechtes, the prison palace of Noshim and Nezikin, or restrict itself to working over 1 or 2 stern. Yet it was not his style. He worked over entire shas, literally entire shas, all shisha sidra shas, and even those which he did not say sure.
He no longer had the luxury that he had in the days when he and his father worked together of polishing and repolishing a few set pieces. Because he was critical of Rosh Yeshiva, of anyone who studied up to Daf Tes or Daf Yud, you had to cut in 40, 50 blot was the usual pace in my time. And that meant constantly moving forward. The way most Rosh Yeshivas handle that problem of pace and meeting Talmidim's needs and the need for constant regurgitation, repetition, to fine-tune ideas, is by creating a certain Seder of 7 or 8 Masechtos. He refused to do so. And again, he ranged over all of Shas indiscriminately. It was a price that he paid in his written error. It was a price that he never thought that he was paying. Or if he did think it, he thought it well worth it. Even in those cases when he did do chazaras, and he did chazaras usually on those mesechtas which were new to him in saying the ones Shashir, such as Shabbos, Nidan, Mikvoyes, Beitza. I think he was the first Rosh Hashiva into Shabbos. I know they sort of look down at a Rosh Hashiva doesn't say Shir on Kutuk Mishum Chadanya. He went in at the time. He did do rewrite. But as all knowledge was drawn from the sources, he could never employ the material he had written up the previous years in order to work out what he had to say the next year. It had to come afresh and anew from the source. I recall we were studying Nida, 13 and a half at the time. My father was making a chazar. And he got stuck in the sugi of Daftes, Horekachazia Benis. Bingo, bingo, and bingo. So I turned to him and said, Papa, you wrote up the shiur last year. Why don't you have a look at it? He gave me a book which those students who studied with him in the 40s and 50s know what I was referring to. I can probably express it best by saying what you'd give a dishonest cockroach who suggested that you cheat, plagiarize, use a pony in Talmud air.
There are some Bali Haroche who get after a while, a single central vision of the Masechta or the Seder. And subsequently they work and rework, polish and repolish again.
My father brought a similarity of method, a identity of method, which guaranteed that certain basic yesodos would emerge in any analysis. But the configuration and specific formulation that it took varied from year to year, from limud to limud. And he was aware of that. It was a second price he paid in terms of his fervor. But as before, I don't think he thought it was a price, and if it was, he didn't mind paying it. My father was a Rosh Hashiva for 45 years. And I look at this crowd now, the wide age diversity. I listen to people who came to be Menachem Oval, and stories that I've heard over the past 2 weeks and before. You were two radically different pictures of a person. The one of the 40s and 50s was a volcano, storming lion in the classroom, impatient, shop down, tolerated no fools, not only didn't tolerate them lightly, didn't tolerate fools at all, and could crouch like a tiger and leap at the slightest error that a student would make. I recall once that he was in his shir, his 40s and 50s, I just heard it. When they came out of the shir, I was visiting New York. It was shir and Shabbos. And he said something, Sparentasis. And the student replied with something else. And my father said, Narishkat. So he said, Rebbe, but you said that last year. So he thought, and said, this is for Narishkat. But that doesn't justify your repeating it now. He said it in a sharper tone than I said it now. And then there was the man of the 60s and 70s, late 60s, 70s, not to speak of the 80s when he was already touched by Parkinson, which was gentle. Appearing, almost very little upset him. And the volume of nonsense, and mistakes, and errors that could go on in the classroom would have astonished anyone. Anyone who knew him in the previous years. I studied with my father from 1947 to 1963. And I was there for the year of my mother's patera, which I was not in New York. Then I came back in 69, say shirim here. And I stepped into my father's shir. And he had a certain difficulty in a taste of the student put up his hand. And he made a suggestion which, to put charitably, was something off the wall. And my father's only response was, interesting. I left the shir in a shock. It wasn't the shir, the person that I had known. And I met Herschel on the way out in Harav Shechter. He asked me where I was from. And I said, I've just come out of my father's shir. And I was silent, and he was silent. We didn't have to speak. We had known each other too many years. We'd been together through too much. And we were silent about 15 seconds, 20 seconds. And as the elevator opened and people filled in, and I decided to go down, I turned to him and I said, Herschel, have you noticed how many more interesting things now there are in my father's year than there ever was in our day? What happened to the person over these years? First, of course, was the death of my mother. From the point of view simply of preparation, what characterized him in the 40s and the 50s was an almost ferocious power of concentration. I don't recall my father working late in the evening, not in my days. I know from letters in Berlin that he writes to the Zeder, it's 2 a.m, 3 a.m. But in my days, basically his work day was over, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. He put in, I would say, about 9-10 hours of total concentration where you could have blown something up and he wouldn't have heard it. It was that enormous preparation which gave him the moral ascendancy over the student and also the force. Because every student in the class in the 40s and 50s knew that though the man knew far more than them and was far able, nevertheless, he had put more hours of preparation to the Gemara than they ever had. And he entered the shir almost like a crouched lion, ready to spring at the first arrow. After my mother's death, he never could concentrate alone. Never. He functioned when people were opposite him. And he also, and which would mean most you would get, would be 4, 5, maybe 6 hours preparation. But how long can you hold people opposite you? And also a great deal of the almost volcanic energy, which had been recharged by her, though they were so different in temperament, was not recharged and never came back. But there was another change, and for me to describe it, to talk about it, I have to go back a bit in time and give some background, not because history, I speak them have no place for history, but to understand where the man came from and why he held certain views that he did. My father was trained by the Zeta, and the Zeta operated on 2 assumptions. First, he was a good masbir, which he was. Second, my father was talented, which he was. Therefore, if after an explanation my father didn't understand, it was because he was lazy and didn't want to understand, and he'd slap his face. Then he'd explain it again and ask him, Pashtestu? Itzte? Poya? My uncle, who told me the story, not my father never talked, that he used to shake his head in fear and say, yeah, Pashtay. My father would clench his teeth and say, Pashtay Nish. Got slapped again. I should say, remember, you're talking about Russia in the early 20th century, which wasn't governed by Spock. Chedorim didn't run by Spock, and a strap and a rattan was common. So a slap was not unusual. But it was one which the Zeta gave him until he finally produced that answer which the Zeta thought appropriate for his talents. Then, not then, but at the same time, these were the war years, 1914 to 1918, when starvation was common, hunger certainly, if not starvation, was common. Then came the aftermath of the First World War, which because of the Holocaust we tend to forget, that close to 250,000 Jews were massacred, pogroms. True, not in Belarusia, more in Ukraine, elsewhere. But a pogrom one place meant the brooding omnipresence and danger and fear of a pogrom elsewhere. And for 3 years, it was Baboko, Miyitin Erev, the Erev Toma, Miyitin Boka. Then they fled to Poland in 1921, a country which was overstaffed, as it were, with refugees and Rabbonim fleeing from Russia. Then to Germany, a foreign language, foreign culture. Then the rise of Hitler, and the waiting for the passport, chances of flee. Then coming to America, and discovering he came as to be a Rosh Yeshiva in Chicago. But since it took about a year for the visa to arrive, when he came, they said, sorry, the post is filled. And so he became a rov. When he went to Boston, tried out for the post, they realized he didn't have a smicha. They hadn't considered that very significant in his career. So they wrote, if I'm not mistaken, to Kovnerov and Reb Simcha Zelek, both of them who knew him well, and they gave my father smicha, and he got the post. Then came 9 years of unmitigated aggravation. He wasn't constitutionally suited to be a rov, especially since he had rather broad ideas of how a city should be run and wasn't able to effectuate any of them. And then came the attacks upon him and the rather ugly battle about succession in yeshiva beginning in Boston, which went on for 3 long years. It wasn't until all that was over that his career took off. Now, why do I tell you all this? Because what seemed the past 40 years as a meteoric career, which only went up and up to a stop life, by age and by sickness, was one which the first 40 years was an endless overcoming of obstacles. And he internalized the Zaydis position, and the first 40 years of struggle only enforced it, that everything was superable by effort and by yagia. Yagati voi mitzosei al tamei. And while we never articulated underlying the fury in the classroom was the essential basic assumption that all intellectual error, most intellectual error, was basically a moral one, a failure of will and of effort. But had they put in the same effort that he put in, they would have arrived at most, if not necessarily all, that he knew. And he lashed out at those failures because they seemed to him marks of laziness and self-indulgence. Then he came down with cancer. It took 4 or 5 years waiting period. But more so, my mother came down with cancer. It was a 4-year period, in which I would say that my father was very much an iceberg, 80% beneath the surface and only 20% above. Though that 20% was sufficient to all people, it drew its strength from the vast underlying mass, which you felt, though didn't see. All those underlying energies were consumed. And she died. And I was with my father another month, before death, after. In fact, I first slept in the same room with him. And at times he spoke in his sleep, which he didn't usually, because I spent subsequently many years in the room, the dormitory. He spoke occasionally to the doctors, more often to the Benishur. And after she passed away, I spent about a month and a half with him. He was disoriented at the time. Disoriented, I meant psychologically, not intellectually. Sometimes I once said my task was he would come into a room and shut off the lights, and my job was to come into the room and put on the lights. which would get him quite angry at times. And we talk, spoke. Then once we were talking, and he groped for words. He was not a person who usually groped for words, though he did stutter. Strange, the greatest orator was a stutterer, the residual stutter, but he didn't grope for words. And he blurted out a sentence. I felt that I'd been swept. By the Rabinishler. What he discovered in those years was a sense of helplessness. That not everything was accomplishable by will. That there were forces which controlled a person's life, a person's feelings and actions, which no effort of will could change. That caused the shift in his philosophical outlook and changed almost completely his attitude towards Talmidim. Because error, laziness, and even stupidity he now saw not as a moral failing, but simply as a human limitation, located perhaps differently than his limitation, but no less real and no less humbling for that fact. But as I look across this audience, think of the people that I've met, hurt and shiver and the like, what struck me was that even though they had known totally different people, people in Boston, Maria know a person totally different from anyone in his shiurim, and even though their experiences with him were so radically different, they were bonded to him in the same way. And I wondered, and I've wondered before, what was it that bonded his students to him in that way? Or put differently, what was it that made him through? You speak of creativity, to be sure, extraordinary powers of exposition, the capacity and antennae almost instantly to adjust to the level of the audience, and then to raise it a bit, not too much, the audience was low, to raise it to the highest level that they could grasp. To be sure, he had all that. But all that would have made him simply a supremely effective teacher. Rebbe, which indeed he was, but it would not have bound and bonded people to him as they were. And the only way I can bring it across to those who didn't experience it, to express it, begin to express it to people who did, was that his shiurim had what you can experience only in a few great moments in great theater, when all of a sudden the reality becomes more real, reality in the room is more real than the real world around you, because truth is expressed in a way which is unabridged and undiminished by the partialities of the mundane world. You have that occasionally, once or twice in a lifetime. It was that ability, it was that feeling that he imparted in his classrooms. When you were in him, with him in the classroom, somehow the only thing in the world that existed was the sheer. And all the rest was not unimportant, but insignificant. And it was this heightened sense of reality and of truth that bound him to his pupils. And what unite, and since what was being transacted in the sheer was not simply thought, though thought it was, but was Nisira, Meirav, or Talmud. What bound the students who cowered before intellectual gladiator of the 40s and 50s, and those who sat at the feet of a gentle, aging giant of the 70s, was a common awareness they knew that he knew that without him, that they knew as he knew that he knew that without them as Talmidi, he could not be what he was. And they responded with an awareness that without him, as Rebbe, they would not be what they were. And so they bonded and have remained so even when Nafshok Matsura Bitsur Hachayim.
We rise for the Haskara, which will be recited by the principal of our high school for boys, Rav Gedalia Finkelstein.
El Molei Rachamim Shochein Bamerami Amitzei menucho nechono al kanefei hashechino b'mahalos kidoshim utahorim kizohar horokia mazirim es nishmas moreinu v'rabeinu rabon shel kol Yisrael horav Yosef Dov Halevi ben moreinu horav Moshe.
Already touched by Parkinson, which was gentle, forbearing, almost very little upset him. And the volume of nonsense, and mistakes, and errors that could go on in the classroom would have astonished anyone, anyone who knew him in the previous years. I studied with my father from 1947 to 1963. And I was there for the year of my mother's Pateria, which I was not in New York. Then I came back in 69, say Shiram here. And I stepped into my father's shir. And he had a certain difficulty in a taste of the student put up his hand. And he made a suggestion which, to put charitably, was something off the wall. And my father's only response was, interesting. I left the shir in a shock. It wasn't the shir, the person that I had known. And I met Herschel on the way out in Harav Shechter. He asked me,
V'yonuach b'sholom al mishkovo v'nomar amen.
Request that we remain in place until the members of the family and those assembled on the platform will leave via this aisle. Thank you.